Dear listeners, Sai Ram, we now bring you a special conversation with Dr. Sunil Menon. This is a two-part interview and today you will be listening to its second part. In conversation with him is Radio Sai's Karuna Munshi, and this interview was recorded in our studio on 21st October 2016. Have a listen, please.
Sai Ram, dear listeners, and welcome to our second conversation with Dr. Sunil Menon, who is the head of the Department of General Medicine at the Sri Sathya Sai General Hospital in Prashanthi Nilayam. In part one of this conversation, Dr. Sunil Menon introduced us to the topic of integrative health, that is a holistic approach to healthcare, and touched upon so many fascinating aspects of health which go beyond just the physical and which resonate or echo what Bhagwan tells us about holistic health, the whole, the mind-body-spirit connection. So to take this conversation further, I have a bunch of questions, and it's interesting because when this interview was played on our live show Morning Glory, as he was speaking, we were getting questions from our listeners, and I will try to incorporate your queries in today's discussion. On that note, I welcome Dr. Sunil Menon. Sai Ram.
Sai Ram, nice to be here.
And it's wonderful to have you here once again with us to learn more from you. So, sir, we'll start with this topic of choosing good fats in our diet. Last week when I asked you a personal question, I said, what kind of fats do you consume? You mentioned ghee and you're in favor of cold-pressed coconut oil. And you said olive oil is also good, but it's an expensive option in this part of the world. Now, if somebody has got cardiac issues or gone through some history of health related to the heart, a bypass or something, would the same advice apply to them?
Well, let me begin by saying that conventional medicine or Western medical practice has always told us, and I was taught the same when I was a postgraduate student, that the main problem is cholesterol. All over the world, we were asked to eat a low-fat, high-carbohydrate, complex-carbohydrate diet. And now, research seems to point the other way. Although cholesterol is one of the agents that is involved in the final problems with atherosclerosis, it is unfortunately not the main thing that's involved in inflammation of the arteries, leading to changes that finally land up with atherosclerosis and a plaque. This is, for the present moment, a very controversial subject. And especially in a talk show to give all the details would not be possible. But the research has now come out in the open, and they are discussing the role of cholesterol, because they find that a large percentage of people who do get heart attacks have normal cholesterol. They also find that lowering the cholesterol levels by different means has not changed how they progress with their condition at all. There are other factors involved, and the main factor they have now focusing on is the use of sugar and refined carbohydrates. They are the main culprits because they cause inflammation in the arteries. They trigger chronic inflammation syndrome, and chronic inflammation is the subject of research today. If people want to know more about the subject, they should try to get some books that has been come out in this area. And one important book that is being well read all around is called The Cholesterol Myth. And we find indigenous people have always been using ghee and coconut oils since thousands of years. Why should they start misbehaving? The problem is the refining and the purity of the source. So if you get pure ghee from a cow who eats grass, it's not going to do any harm to you. If you use cold-pressed oils in your diet, they found the body takes care of it. Simply said, God did not create cholesterol for it to go and block your heart. Cholesterol is an important agent in our body. It does a lot of important functions. So the theory that lowering cholesterol is the magic bullet that can cure heart disease is gone out of the window. But a case of warning, people who had heart attacks or got issues and they have got coronary artery disease, we wouldn't ask them to suddenly start using saturated oil in their diets. We would prefer that they keep control on that and reduce it as far as possible. But as far as the contribution of cholesterol to heart conditions, that theory is now changing. And I recommend people to, you know, go on the web or go to a doctor who can talk more about it. My recommendation is if somebody needs to know, they should go to a doctor who knows a little bit of nutritional medicine and the role of fats in the body. And doctors who are in the States, they are known as functional medicine doctors. And if whoever wants to know about this meets a functional medicine doctor, he will get a direct input of how much of these oils he can use.
Very interesting. And I remember reading somewhere that even the French cuisine, which is pretty heavy on cheese and butter and widely used, and people eat croissants and, you know, all kinds of confectionaries, even they don't have such a high rate of heart problem as compared to Americans.
Absolutely right. The fact is, when the initial studies were done a long, long time ago, the doctor who introduced this theory had actually tweaked the results. And he left France out because France didn't fit into his theory at all.
Oh.
And it's called the seven countries theory. So he picked seven countries that fitted the theory he had.
Which is that cholesterol is the culprit.
Is the culprit. And and then the rest of the bandwagon picked it up. Unfortunately, that's how science goes somewhere, because he was a very persuasive and a very strongly opinionated doctor. And people listened to him. And he wrote up this research paper and people said yes. And now they went back to the original study and found that compared to, I think, about 21 countries were involved, and he picked only seven that fitted his results. So that is why the theory is now really being looked at, and people don't really believe that there is a direct connection between levels of cholesterol. In fact, a new cholesterol test has come. They don't look at just levels of cholesterol. They look at what is known as the particles and particle size. And they found LDL, which has been, you know, maligned as a very bad particle. It's got two forms, LDL-A and LDL-B. If you got high LDL and it's all LDL-A, you're fine. You can eat as much saturated fat as you can. Unfortunately, if you have high levels of LDL-B, that is where the problem comes. So just saying cholesterol is not enough. We need to do this new test that's been used in the States for quite a long time. It's not come to all the countries yet. But people are aware of the test, usually ask the patient to do it, and then classify you as which category you belong to. If you belong to LDL-B, then they'll ask you to be careful.
Okay, that is more precise to understand. Now, I had a question, because in this age and day, we hear a lot about this word detox. Everybody is doing a detox. And if you read Swami's literature, Swami says the detox has to begin at a very deep level with all the emotion, the ties we carry, the psychological burden, maybe past life from before or childhood. What are your thoughts on this?
To answer that question very simply, the detox we talk about is only for the body. And as far as we know, ancient cultures and most of the Chinese Ayurvedic systems, the naturopathy systems, they always talk about you have to detox your body once in a while. In the past, I think families used to give people castor oil and clear the system. They used to do things like that. Detox is a natural process. The liver is the main organ. And it's got phase one, phase two detox systems. It was actually meant for toxins which are present even in normal food. We presume that normal food is non-toxic, but that's not the case. There are things in there, chemicals in there, the body doesn't need. And when we say detox, means the body throws away the items of the food that is harmful to the body in the long run and not useful to the body. That's what detox is all about. And the liver does it all the time. Unfortunately, of course, in today's world, we are detoxing chemicals, which the human being is facing for the first time. And that is where the problem comes. The liver doesn't know what to do with it. It gets overburdened with things it has not seen before in our biological origin. And invariably, they tend to create health issues which need to be addressed one way or the other. The best way is to keep away from these items, but unfortunately we can't. processing of food has created a large percentage of items that slip through the system. And
the preservatives.
Very true. So what does the liver do? Now, detoxing has two processes. It has to throw it out. If these things are soluble in fat, it throws it out through the bile.
Okay.
If it is soluble in water, it throws it out through the kidney.
Okay.
Some things can actually come out in your sweat, which means if a hot sauna, running and exercising and sweating a lot is one way your body naturally detoxes. And
what if you don't have a gallbladder, if you have removed it?
Is a problem. Yes, true. We have to replace the bile with ox bile or some kind of substitutions. We have to be very, very careful. We have to take enzyme supplements that will help in the liver. It's an important question because people without a gallbladder, detoxifying is an issue. They have to be very, very careful that they don't eat oily food. Mm-hmm. They eat food that they can digest and they keep away from things which are not organic.
Mm.
The liver generally doesn't function, you know, that efficiently, which is why extra supplementation is recommended, which is what we do. So as I was saying that detoxing is a natural process and the modern lifestyle has created issues, and so we periodically should have a process of detoxing, and the simplest way is to go on a juice fast, or I don't recommend dramatic fasting. It's not a very healthy option. A lot of people can't do it. But if you switch to a fruit juice or a vegetable juice or some kind of a liquid fast, which will help the body system to really re-gear itself and the liver to get a little break from, you know, how busy it is.
I see.
And that's the simplest form you can do at home.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to go to a dramatic form of detoxing, then, you know, they do it in a very dramatic way by giving you a lot of detoxing supplements. You have to get then admitted to a place and, you know, they detox you.
Yeah.
Along with cleansing, which way they do colonic cleansing and then they call it lymphatic cleansing where they do massage, which is part of the Ayurvedic process.
Yes.
The choice is what your body can stand, because a lot of people can't detox very well. So when they start detoxing, all these chemicals that are hiding in their system will come out and they feel worse for some time. So detoxing sometimes is to be done under supervision.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest problem is heavy metals, which are there in our system, they hide in our fat cells. And that's the only thing the body can do. It can't throw it out, it can't detox. So they hide it in our fat cells. And if you try to detox, these heavy metals can come back into the blood and cause issues. So doctors recommend that you remove the heavy metals first by a process of chelation. And that's again, you know, in a hospital environment by special units who have experience in it. You have to measure the levels of heavy metals in your body, and there are various tests that can do that. Unfortunately, in India, we don't really do much of this. But in the States, especially the functional medicine group of doctors, they tend to measure the toxins in your system.
I think in India, we've sort of caught up between our own culture and this wisdom and our desire to ape the Western culture without quite having the know-how, because in ancient times, you might have noticed a lot of Indians, Hindus especially, fast during the two Navratris of October and April, and it's supposed to be, actually, in Vedic age, that was how people would detoxify during the change of weather. Because one was during spring, leading to summer, the other is at fall, leading to winter. So they would fast for the 9 days to prepare their body for the next season. But now it's become associated with the puja and everything. Over time, many things are lost in translation. But we did have our own detoxing systems, and we would do a lot of prayers to clear our mind and our emotions. But that's sort of lost in rituals now, unfortunately. Now, last week you talked to us about the koshas or the sheets, the different layers that make a person, and you touched upon the physical and the mental, pranamaya and manomaya kosha. Could you go beyond that and enlighten us, doctor, please?
The koshas are so important because generally when we look at the body, we tend to focus on the physical body. And Swami has taught a lot about food has got a subtle element. And it's the subtle element of the food that goes into the manomaya kosha. So what you eat becomes a part of your mind.
Okay.
And these are, in quantum physics terms, these are all vibrations. And food, every molecule, every atom has got its own harmonics and vibrations. And which is why, although you may say animal food, actually it's got animal vibrations.
Mm.
Now, science has not measured it, and unfortunately we don't accept this as scientific truth. But Swami has clearly said that the whole universe is just made of vibrations in different forms. And these vibrations can be transferred. And we talk about positive vibrations, negative vibrations. Food itself is a chemical system. And as the Annamaya Kosha absorbs the physical bit of it, we presume that the nothing else happens. But then what happens is the subtle vibrations get through. You have to be very careful about not even the food itself, but who cooked it. Because the Vedic theory says that even the person who cooked the food is important.
Yeah, the thoughts of that person are transferred.
That's right. So you cook it with love, you cook it with affection, you cook it not in haste. And then you eat food in a divine fashion. So instead of watching television and talking and arguing and losing your energy, you actually conserve your energy. And the reason for that, you do it in a meditative fashion because it is you are transferring vibrations. And that should be done in that fashion so that the body then will pick and do its job. You know, we also do the food prayer, which is important. Again, you know, we clear any negative influences. And all this affects the mind. And so the basic thing starts with eating, format of eating and selection of the food, which can affect the mind. That is step number one.
Mm-hmm.
That will create positive vibrations in the mind itself. And then, of course, you have to train the mind. And invariably, you know, that's a process where you can't control it. You can't order it. The mind is always like a horse. And you have to rein in. You have to rein in the mind all the time. And it comes only with practice. It's not part of the medical philosophy to tell a patient to do that. But we found that patients with a very positive attitude, with faith in the doctor and faith in the treatment, tend to, you know, improve and get cured and give good results.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not rocket science to understand that the mind is playing a part.
Mm-hmm.
And we all understand it, but in today's hectic world, you know, we all become an assembly line practice.
Mm-hmm.
We hardly give much time to the patient. And the patient also wants instant results. So that's the connection between that. The pranamaya kosha is something which is ignored entirely because that's the energy body. And the energy body, or the prana as we call it, it's got energy flow in our system. And there are ways in which the energy can get blocked and ways in which the energy is transferred. And it should flow. The first rule of law is this energy should flow. It should also concentrate in areas where you are at. So basically, if you are doing a job which is very animal-based or you're just digesting food, most of the energy goes there. As your thoughts, processes and your way of lifestyle changes, your energy starts or should be getting focused at a higher level. And people have sort of understood this, like the chakras and the Kundalini Shakti, how it is, you know, it raises itself and all that, which again is not scientific proof, but that is what the yogis have been doing. The fact is that if you are functioning at the optimal energy level for whatever job you're doing, you'll find you're functioning better and your results are better. It is only when we have a very distracted format of addressing a problem, we are thinking one thing and saying another thing and doing another thing, that shows your energy flow is not very controlled.
And you don't have Trikarna Shuddhi.
Exactly. And the yogis talk about how this can be sorted. There are various methodologies to address, but that needs a guru to do that. I mean, each person has their own methodology of rectifying their energy processes. Depending on where you are, they will recommend a particular process. It's not a standard therapy for 50 people, sit down and, you know, reset your energy levels. The guru actually selects. Most of us are at a very baseline level. And you'll find that some baseline practices will help us out in some way to function in the world better. If you want to go into the spiritual realm, then that's an entirely different process where it has to be individually prescribed.
I see. Very deep. Wow. Okay. Now, a not so deep question. Last week you spoke about some animals that make their own vitamin C, and it was noticed in research that when they were ill, the production of vitamin C went up by 1,000% to fight. Now, as an immunity booster, first of all, how much vitamin C should one aim for? What are good sources in your opinion? And we hear that cancer also can respond, early stages of cancer can respond to enhanced immunity. What are your thoughts on that, doctor?
Again, the question, as far as conventional medicine is concerned, they don't agree with the use of vitamin C. They also presume that you are getting enough vitamin C. The question we have to ask is, does your body need more? And they have found that that is true. Mm-hmm. Even if you are eating the required amount of fruits and vegetables and raw food and fresh food, your body may be needing more. This is again very individual, and we find that some people need much more than the others, mm-hmm. because their immune system is under stress and they got issues in the body that is using up vitamin C a lot. It needs a prescriber to decide from your symptoms and your history and your background of your diet and your illness whether vitamin C is required or not. Non-conventional medicine has done a lot of work on this, mm-hmm. and in fact, most of the doctors who practice this form of medicine, they tend to be out of mainstream medicine. They got results which are amazing, where they use extremely high doses of vitamin C. They can't claim that the condition is cured, but the quality of life changes. So patients who have been given up hope and who have said that, you know, the cancer is spread all over the body, you've got 6 months to live, have continued to live for 5 years with a good quality of life. People who had infections that were not responding when vitamin C was added to the regimen, they found dramatically, you know, the condition can improve. The dosage, you know, can't be really mentioned as a general format. Mm-hmm. But if you get about 200 to 400 milligrams of vitamin C, so you need a nutritionist to find out what you're eating and whether you're eating it fresh. If you cook it and if you preserve it and if you eat it after 3 days, then the vitamin C is gone. It oxidizes very quickly. But if you get fresh wheat, you know, a mango from the tree, you know, the chances of getting vitamin C, or a papaya from the plant itself. Papaya has got a lot of vitamin C. Amla has got a lot of vitamin C.
Amla is the Indian gooseberry.
Indian gooseberry.
Yeah.
It depends on how fresh it is. Mm-hmm. If you're not sure that you need vitamin C, you get repeated colds and repeated infections and you find that, okay, you've got skin issues that keep coming and going. If your doctor feels that maybe your immune system needs a little boost, you can try taking some vitamin C.
Supplement.
Mm-hmm. The problem is synthetic vitamin C that's available over the counter.
Yeah.
They're not very good. And of course, they're not bad, but they're not good enough to really supplement your needs. So either it's fresh food or it is a supplement which is not in a synthetic form.
How about something like lemon juice?
You have to sort of drink a lot of it to get the required amount. Okay. So that is the problem. So if you eat about 6 or 7 oranges a day, or 7 or 8 apples a day, you know,
That's a lot.
So that's the reason a supplement is a shortcut to that, provided you get a standard one from a good company.
Mm-hmm.
It should certainly go a long way.
Now, there's this talk about the fight between alkaline and acid. We hear a lot, because cancer has become so rampant around us, that if our bodies are more alkaline, then the chances of cancer cells growing are less.
It's again, like I said, not in conventional medicine. We don't really believe that theory at all, and nor we change the diet for a cancer patient. But like I said, people who have been working on this area, they have found that foods can be classified as acid alkaline, or those that fall in the middle. In a general way, all the meats are acidic, and the grains also belong to the same group. It's only the vegetables and the fruits are alkaline.
Which are alkaline.
So one of the ways of treating cancer patients is with raw food diet. And you know, they eat sprouts and raw food diet, and they keep off dairy products and grains and meat, which is a tough call because it is impossible, you know, not to include one of these items. But they can eat rare forms of, you know, quinoa or amaranth or seeds as a substitute. To eat that way is not easy. It's not easily available. And then to stick to it is extremely difficult. But what these researchers have found, that the human beings can live pretty okay with that kind of diet. And they are pretty surprised. And are quite surprised how that is happening.
So this is the diet of seeds and these rare grains and fruits and vegetables.
And fruits and vegetables. fruits. Yeah,
that's what rishis ate, right? They ate
very
nuts,
true, fruits. And such, and well, seeds and nuts.
Seeds and nuts. Yeah. Now, Swami says, you know, some people are rogis, bhogis, and yogis, and the yogis ate what you are prescribing or suggesting for some patients who have cancer. And Swami also says, when you sit down to a meal, you finish a meal, you should get up feeling as light as when you sat. So that's real serious calorie restriction, right?
You see, the thing is, few people realize normal people are constantly producing cancer cells.
Mm-hmm.
We don't realize it. They are cells that's gone the wrong way. So we presume cancer is some huge thing that just jumped on you. It isn't the case. All of us are producing cancer cells and they're getting mopped up.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as your system works efficiently to mop them up, you're fine.
Mm-hmm.
So cancer is not a bogeyman that comes and catches you.
Mm-hmm.
It's there. So it's a reality of natural life.
Mm-hmm.
If the environment, your diet, your lifestyle helps the cancer, then it picks up speed and goes to some part of your body and it grows. The problem is cancer survives on glucose and sugar. And our diet is basically supplying a lot of sugar to the cancer cells. We have to starve them. One of the ways of killing them off is to starve them.
Starve them of sugar.
Of sugar. And the way to do that is to go on a high complex raw food diet, which actually starves them of direct sugars. So that's how the theory came up, and you know they applied this to patients, and they found some of the cancers, you know, go into remission.
Mm-hmm. How does one determine how many calories one should consume to maintain an optimal kind of health? Obviously, it'll depend on your height and weight, but Swami is suggesting very light eating habits, right? And most of us need that mental satisfaction of having had a good, satisfying meal.
I think that's a very good question you asked, because the controversy in nutritional medicine is all about this. Calorie in and calorie out.
Mm.
That theory is unfortunately gone.
Okay.
It depends on how you burn calories. So if your body is a fast burner and burns calories very well, you're lucky. You got a fast metabolism and you can eat what you like. If your body has a slow metabolism, then you have to be extremely careful, because a little bit of cheating and you put on weight. Well, how do we switch you and make you a fast metabolizer?
Yes, please tell us.
is the question everybody asks me quite a lot. And that's where the whole new theory about fat comes in.
Mm-hmm.
You see, if you want to feel full and satisfied, you have to eat fat. And fat, unfortunately, is not the problem. It is sugar.
Mm-hmm.
So what people do is they drastically diet and they feel terribly hungry. And then they actually eat a carb-based food or a sugar-based food, which even a small amount can switch the other way. Fat, the body really can't use much. And in order to burn fat, it needs energy. And, you know, fat is something that helps you go thin. So there's a new book that's come up, and I was looking through it recently. It's called Eat Fat and Get Thin.
Mm-hmm.
And that theory has now come up, and they got a lot of scientific evidence. And where the evidence came from is, when they tried to fatten pigs with oil, they thought if you give them extra oil, they'll all fatten up and they can be sold, because the
and
weight increased.
And it was coconut
increased.
Oil, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And unfortunately for them, after 3 months, the pigs lost weight. So they were very surprised that what is fat doing? So fat actually has got a system in the body where it switches the body to the other side.
Hmm.
And Atkins diet, which became very famous,
yes.
It's not a good diet to follow, but all he did was tell patients to eat meat and fat.
Fat, yeah.
And what happened? They felt the weight disappeared
because of the ketosis, but it was temporary and it affected people's kidneys.
True. The trouble is now they've changed that. The new Atkins diet is now a little more sensible.
Now they're more glycemic in there.
Yeah. So invariably what we must realize is we must be sensible about this, and you have to get supervised before you do all this. But what I mean is, today's world, the problem is carbohydrates and refined carbohydrates and sugar that is sneaking into our food all the time. And it's not the poor fat. You can eat as much ghee as you want, and nothing will happen to you, provided you are a fast metabolizer and, you know, you're compensating it with the other nutrients. So eating fat becomes fat theory is gone.
Hmm. Okay, tell us a little bit more about how to convert a slow metabolism into a fast one.
It's not very easy, because a lot of genetics are involved. So you're born with, you know, a type of metabolism. And
so you're fighting nature.
Which is fighting nature. And in fact, now what they do is they don't have a standard diet prescribed for everybody. They say that you come into our office, we see what you do with food. So they got a lot of diet possibilities. And they find, to their surprise, when they mix and match certain types of foods, they reach a formula for you and say that as long as you are eating these kinds of foods and as long as your hormones are working, you know, because your thyroid hormone and your cortisol, your stress factors, how you think, how you act, are you a type A personality or not, all these factors act with each other. So today the science of dieting is not that straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go in and find out, how does my body work?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, a lot of patients know that when they do certain things, they put on weight very quickly. And they cheat on it, and they don't keep to a diet because it's boring, because they can't live in the world by being peculiar and eating certain peculiar things. But strictly speaking, the main problem is sugar and processed food. If you take that out,
everything comes back to that. Yeah. I hear from what you're saying, whatever reduces to a simple sugar is the culprit.
Because all stories tell us that when people were traveling around the world and they lived with the indigenous cultures,
right,
they lost weight.
Mm-hmm.
They became scrawny, thin, mm-hmm, and the muscle area built up, the muscle strength built up, and the fat melted away.
Mm-hmm.
Just because they shifted to a very basic, natural, indigenous diet the tribals were eating, where the food most probably was not overcooked,
mm-hmm,
had all the vitamins and nutrients, and was well balanced,
mm-hmm,
and didn't have all the extra cooking processes which destroyed the nutrients in them.
Mm-hmm. Doctor, you spoke about these traditional diets, so it reminded me, I have a question here from a listener of our show, Rekha Loknath, who wanted to know your thoughts on the millet diet to keep diabetes under control.
Well, if she's talking about finger millet,
yes,
and that is the ragi,
yes,
we have found that if you eat it in the traditional way, the trouble with the food is if it is processed.
Okay.
The ragi is classified depending on the methodology used to measure it. Some people say the glycemic index is very low. Some people say the glycemic index is very high. It depends on particle size again. So if you eat ragi in its traditional fashion,
which is what, like a mudda, like a steaming?
Yeah, and it's not milled by, you know, a machine milling process,
okay,
where it's made into ragi flour.
Okay.
The main good effect of ragi is the high fiber content.
Okay.
And it is the fiber that's really helpful here. So we know that high complex carbohydrate, fiber-filled foods are safe. So it's not just the millet. You have to see what is the source, how has it been manufactured and processed. And if it is traditionally made, then that is a good substitute as compared to wheat and rice.
Now, there's so many millets out there, finger millet, foxtail millet.
Yeah.
What's the mystery behind?
Well, they all come from different sources and different
varieties.
And quinoa
also seems to be
actually, it's a seed. So
it's a seed. Okay.
So the thing is, you don't have to be very exotic because millet is a very good substitute.
And bajra is not different from millet.
Yeah, it's also a type of, I think it's called sorghum or something of the sort, isn't it? These things, you know, traditionally, you know, there's a new science come up. If you genetically belong to a particular class of people who through centuries have eaten a particular diet, then your genes actually are built to do that. So when you're switching diet, you must check whether it agrees with you. For example, in France and Scandinavia, they can drink milk. They don't have lactose intolerance at all. It's unknown because they have traditionally been drinking milk. Unlike the problems with milk all over the world, 70% of people can't tolerate milk. They're intolerant to it. The other problem is milk comes in two forms, A1 and A2. So all these things matter, where we come from, what our forefathers have been eating, because we are the genetic inheritance of our forefathers.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, about exercise, what's the skinny on that? How much of exercise should one incorporate in our lifestyle? Is it necessary? Is just an active lifestyle good enough?
Yeah, I can try to simplify it as much as possible, because again, that's a subject which is sold all over the world. And exercise has become a fashion, and people are making a lot of money. You know,
celebrities, especially.
And exactly, and they're building up six packs and whatever they call it. The fact is, yes, there are two forms of exercise. One is aerobic, and the other is resistance exercises. And aerobic exercises use up oxygen, and the simplest thing is go walking. And
mm-hmm.
30 minutes is what recommended, at least thrice a week, if it's possible for you. We would start with the program of, walking briskly the first 5 minutes, the other way around. You walk pretty slowly in the first 5 to 10 minutes, and then you make it very brisk in the middle part of it. And then in the last bit of it, you slow down again. You need not do walking. You can do yoga. You can do anything that actually affects your breathing.
Mm-hmm.
So we call it aerobic because you tend to breathe faster. There is another point is your heart rate should be built up to a certain level to get the effect of the exercise. So if it doesn't go around, there's a calculation for it. And people can calculate what your heart rate should be. The other bit is the resistance exercises, which again can use machines, which is mainly for the muscles, which is also good to keep it on tone and to build the muscle strength, and old people should try some of it. You can use your own body weight against resistance for that at home. Again, yoga is very good. It's an alternative which you can do. How many minutes of yoga do you need? Well, it depends on your experience with doing exercises and yoga. You build on what you're doing. They'll give you more and more difficult asanas. If it is jogging, usually we recommend around 4 kilometers a day is enough. If you can do, you don't do 4 kilometers on the first day. You start with one and then keep building it up, which should make you do it within 30 to 40 minutes. The idea is people tend to adjust the exercise. How do we know it has worked? Well, your body weight will come down and you'll feel fitter and you'll feel more energetic. And when you reach a threshold of feeling good, you stop. Don't try to overdo it because that is as bad.
Mm-hmm. Too much of anything. You spoke about six packs, so I wanted to know, a listener had a question, is it ever possible to achieve one of those on a vegetarian diet, because there's so much emphasis on protein these days?
Well, that is the question frequently asked by vegetarians. Now, what we don't understand or we don't know is that vegetables contain protein too. So we feel protein has to be in a living animal or from meat or meat product. A protein is there in lentils and legumes. The problem with the protein intake is you need a variety of proteins to get the essential amino acids. So if you are eating a diet which doesn't have this variety, we are in trouble. Poverty is the big issue in India. So most of the poor people, just to fill their bellies, they have substituted a balanced diet with carbohydrate. And that is the issue here. A vegetarian should be balancing the diet a little carefully. So if you're a pure vegetarian, you must see these are the kind of lentils I'm going to go through in a week's time.
Mm-hmm.
And rotate them and mix the lentils and mix the legumes. So as you mix, the protein quality improves. A lot of people...
But which are lentils and which are legumes?
Well, pardon? The dals are the lentils and the beans are the legumes.
Beans are the legumes, like rajma and chana.
Yeah, and if you mix them, the quality of the protein doubles.
Oh, that's very good to know.
And, that's the way to eat. So basically, if you're cooking,
you can mix the two.
Yeah. Along with the vegetables. So we tend to stick to, a standard way of, people buy the same dal, the same bean, the same boring way. So
it's
the idea is
to get creative.
The more creative you are, the more you mix, the quality improves. So you're balanced.
Last week on the show, you spoke about Dr. Dean Ornish's study and his startling findings. Could you throw some light on that, sir?
Yes, Dean Ornish is a very, very interesting person because he was the first person who had the courage to challenge the usual thinking in conventional medicine that a holistic approach will not help. And he picked a number of extremely serious cardiac cases. And he changed their diet completely. And in fact, he put them on a very organic vegetarian diet. And he took off all the processed food and the sugars. And then he put them on a holistic program, which included meditation and yoga. And the results were quite startling. And this was, looked at by other doctors and other institutions picked it up. And now Dean Ornish himself has got his own institute who runs the program. And invariably, the improvement was dramatic. They didn't expect that these cases who were having a poor quality life, conventional medicine wasn't helping them much. And Dean Ornish then started off linking a holistic approach to health, saying that it's just not the diet change. And in his case, quite a large percentage of the improvement was the diet change. But he also introduced the holistic approach of yoga and meditation, something called group therapy, because isolation and loneliness and ignoring the human contact has got very bad health effects. Yeah. And invariably stress is the underlying factor. So now we understand that chronic long-term stress can produce cancer, it can produce heart attacks, it can produce name any disease, and chronic long-term stress is the background of all the issues. We should address that in one form or the other. And Dean Ornish's approach, which seems to address all the factors, including, as now we know, the mind, body, spirit. And in a way, he is the pioneer who introduced that approach. Now that has been worked on by other doctors, and it has been taken further on, saying that we need to not only correct the mind, body, spirit, but our whole lifestyle of living in this artificial environment, artificial light, television whole day long, mobile phones in your pocket. So we are being hit by electromagnetic radiation, we have been hit by preservatives in the food, we have been hit by toxins in the atmosphere. So it's a tough situation for modern man, because we are being hit on all sides, and the human body is suffering because of it.
I see. So my final question then becomes, Dr. Menon, how do you practice integrative medicine in the Sri Satyasai General Hospital?
We haven't started practicing it in the full form, because we're going to have a first seminar on it this Sunday.
Oh, wonderful.
We are going to introduce...
On October the 24th.
23rd, I think, is it?
Okay.
Yes, that's the first seminar. We're going to introduce our doctors to the idea. We're having Dr. Acharya, who's the director of Whitefield Hospital, who's a visiting dermatologist. And he is very much into holistic approach and integrated approach in medicine. And he's going to give a keynote address. And he's got a lot of success curing psoriasis and dermatitis and chronic eczemas by having a holistic approach.
That's a great tip, because a listener did send a question about that. So that is Dr. Acharya from our Whitefield Hospital.
That's right, yes. And he's going to introduce what his findings are and what the success rate is. Which will be interesting to know. So we are building on some of this philosophy. We already got the yoga section started off, and we got Dr. Hema, who's joined us recently, who does the yoga.
So she does yoga with the patients?
With the patients. So we actually refer patients to her with different issues. And what she has done is modified the yoga to make it 21st century. That is very simple. You can sit on a chair and do it. And you can do it for just about 10 minutes a day. And she's blessed by Swami for it. So Swami told her to come back to Parthi and do this. So when she retired, she remembered the promise, and she's come back to help us. And she actually goes all over the world teaching this what I call shotgun yoga, because it's very simple, it's very quick, and it doesn't need you to take a lesson from a guru for 10 years. It just needs about half an hour to learn it from her. And we are trying to find out what the results are. Her results in her personal experience is very good, but we are going to make it evidence based, and we are going to see and follow these patients for at least a year. And maybe next year we'll have some more information on the success of it.
Wonderful. And we will look forward to sharing it with our listeners on Radio Sai.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Sai Ram.
Sai Ram.
Sai Ram. You just heard to a special conversation with Dr. Sunil Menon. In conversation with him was Radio Sai's Karuna Munshi. And this interview was recorded in our studio on 14th October 2016. This was a two-part interview, and today you listen to its second part. As always, dear listeners, your feedback is very valuable to us. Please send us your comments and suggestions to listener@radiosai.org. Thank you, and loving Sai Ram from Prashant Nilayan. Thank you.
उत्तुंग युग्मार्जुन भंग